morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. I'd like to introduce Craig Eisendrath. He's the chairman of the Project for Nuclear Awareness, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, and the author of Bush League Diplomacy. And he's co-author of the new book, The War in Heaven, The Arms Race in Outer Space, published by the New Press. The history of space exploration is very recent, but when did people start thinking about using outer space not only as something to be explored, but something to be used?
Well, very, very quickly after we launched our first satellites. Our first satellites went up in January of 1958, and immediately there was a question, what would we do with outer space? Would we use it for military purposes, or would we use it for peaceful purposes? And, of course, the military purposes were quite apparent, because what the satellites allowed us to do was overfly the Soviet Union and actually look at their missile launch sites and actually detect if there were a missile launch. And this gave us an enormous amount of security, because they could no longer make a first strike on the United States with impunity. We could strike back immediately. And this standoff really kept the Cold War peaceful for a number of decades. But at the same time, we saw that there were real peaceful uses of outer space. We could use outer space for communication satellites, for weather satellites, for positioning satellites, and also for scientific exploration. Up until that time, we'd only been able to look at our solar system and our galaxy and the universe through the fog of the atmosphere. But after that, after we could get into outer space, we had this completely clear vision of what the universe looked like.
Now, we talk about satellites all the time. We talk about satellite TV and radio and GPS and so on. But what actually is a satellite, that is a man-made satellite?
Well, a satellite is a hard object that is circling the Earth. In low Earth orbit, a satellite travels around 17,000 miles an hour and goes around in about 90 minutes. If you get up to 22,300 miles up there, a satellite goes around the Earth at exactly the same rate as the world turns, as the Earth turns, so that in effect it's stationary.
And so those
two kinds of satellites, that is low Earth orbit and stationary satellites, are the main kinds we use.
Now, you've talked about a few of the commercial and scientific uses of satellites. What are the military uses of satellites?
Well, there's really, as I say, three main uses. One is for observation. From a satellite, you can exactly pinpoint a target. And as I say, right at the very beginning, from 1958 on, we started developing satellites that could overfly our possible enemies, find out where their missile launch sites were, and also detect if they made a missile launch. So that was one big use. That is of observation. Recently, we've extended that use because we now can use those satellites to direct rockets and bombs right onto target. And starting with the Gulf War, you know, we started using satellites to do that. In fact, most of the hits that we made, for instance, in the recent Iraq War, the 2003 war, were satellite directed. So that's one big use. Now, another use is to actually put a weapon into outer space, which is designed to knock out missiles as they arch into outer space, or to knock out other satellites. And these are called ASATs. And they're basically, what they do is they ram into their target, or they shoot lasers, and they destroy the target in outer space. Now, a third use is to use these satellites to bombard the Earth. That is, you can shoot down a laser to knock out, let's say, a missile which is about to be launched. You can actually send hard metal objects down from outer space to penetrate bunkers. You can bomb areas, you know, with explosives, which can be conventional explosives or nuclear. And the United States is developing, has developed the first type and is and actually orbited them. And the second and third type are types of which we have under development.
Now, you write that there's a serious conflict between military and commercial and scientific use of space. Why is that?
Well, one of the big reasons is this. If you put a military satellite in outer space, let's say a satellite that's designed to destroy another satellite, you're going to have to test it. If you test it, what you do is you create debris. That is, you create pieces of the thing you've destroyed in outer space. Now, this debris goes around extremely fast. For instance, a 10-pound piece of debris, because of the speed, hits another satellite with the power of a truck. And what that means is that peaceful uses of outer space for communication, for weather, for positioning, for scientific use, all these satellites are in jeopardy because of the debris that's circulating around at these very high speeds.
Now, does that debris exist, or is it something that's a danger if we start testing these types of military applications that you're talking about?
Well, there's already some debris up there because we've already done some testing. For instance, we've done some testing of our missile defense system, and that creates debris, and so, by the way, of other countries. They've done some testing up there. There is debris. Recently, for instance, you may have read the Chinese destroyed one of their own satellites from the Earth. They shot a missile and knocked one of their own satellites out. That increased the amount of debris in an outer space by a factor of 10%, or just one blast like this. Very dangerous. There is already debris up there.
I would think it would also get in the way of the work that we're doing from the Earth when we look at the sky through telescopes.
Well, it does, because if you can't, if you're going through a lot of fog, a lot of material, you're not going to be able to see very well. That's not a real danger yet, because there's got to be an enormous amount of debris to actually block your vision from the Earth. But the real danger is putting debris up there, which will make satellites impossible. Another danger is that military satellites take up the very rare radio frequencies that you need to communicate, so that there's only a band of radio frequencies, and the radio frequencies are scarce. If they're taken over by the military, that means that the peaceful uses don't have the radio frequencies they need. So that's still another danger.
We're talking to Craig Eisendrath, co-author of The War in Heaven, The Arms Race in Outer Space. Now, this debris circulates around the Earth at the same speed as the satellite.
Exactly. And as I say, in low Earth orbit, that's 17,000 miles an hour. That's fast.
That's fast indeed.
That is fast.
So hitting a piece of debris is a very dangerous proposition.
Oh, incredible. Even a very small piece can knock a satellite. You just put it into pieces because of the enormous power of something going at that speed.
Now, under Ronald Reagan's presidency, we had a buildup of missile defense programs nicknamed Star Wars. What were these programs? What were they attempting to do, and to what extent did they succeed in doing so?
Well, they were really way out. One of them was called an X-ray laser, and this was actually a nuclear explosion in outer space, and the energy was then directed to knock out missiles and other satellites. despite the fact that we had a treaty, the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which said you cannot orbit weapons of mass destruction in outer space, and we had a 1963 treaty that said you couldn't test weapons of mass destruction in outer space. So Reagan was just ignoring both those things. The other system he developed or tried to develop was something called Brilliant Pebbles. And these were small, what they're called microsatellites, very small satellites, thousands of them, which would be circulating around and then would swoop down on a missile or another satellite. Now the problem there, this is sort of funny, but the problem there is they kept on adding equipment to these little satellites so that they could hone in on their targets better. And they got heavier and heavier and heavier. And somebody quipped that these brilliant pebbles had become brilliant boulders.
Right.
and once they were brilliant boulders, they got so expensive that even Reagan had to back off and say, look, we don't have the money for these things.
Well, wasn't there a real attempt to create a defense system that, let's say, you know, the Soviet Union launched a missile against the United States, that we would have a system that would then take that missile out from midair?
Yeah. Well, we've actually installed what's called a mid-course missile defense system in Alaska and in California. And this is a system that's designed to knock a incoming intercontinental ballistic missile in outer space. But it's got some terrible problems. The biggest problem, of course, is it doesn't work. And it doesn't work because, for instance, one of the things that we're doing right now is we're programming its flight characteristic into our computer so we can knock the thing down. I mean, this is not exactly a realistic test. And the second thing is even worse. We can't distinguish the warhead from a decoy.
Right.
You see, if you launch a warhead, you know, an ICBM, what you can do is you can launch 50 to 100 balloons alongside the warhead. And because they're in outer space, because there's no air resistance, they travel exactly in the same path as the warhead. You can't tell one from the other. If you make them the same temperature and the same shape, they look exactly alike. We've never been able to solve that problem. And we've known about that problem, frankly, since the late 50s. And we've spent about $140 to $50 billion on a missile defense system, which still doesn't work.
To what extent is it, and I'm out of my depths here in terms of the physics of it, but to what extent is it physically possible to stop a missile that's already been launched? I mean, it's going very, very fast.
Sure.
Is it like trying to stop a bullet by swinging a stick?
Yeah, exactly. It's like stopping a bullet with a bullet. Now, you can do it. You can actually track the thing with sensitive equipment, and you can then impact it and destroy it. It is possible. And we have done it a few times. But as I say, because most of the time these tests fail, and most of the time we can't distinguish a decoy from the warhead, we've got a system where we spent tens of billions of dollars, and the thing just doesn't work. And you ask, why did we put it in when we knew it didn't work? And then you've got to get into the ugly facts of lobbying, the fact that Boeing and Raytheon and Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin, the big contractors, are really spreading millions of dollars around to get these contracts.
When you mentioned the price tag of $100 billion plus, that's still nothing compared to the cost of the Iraq war.
Well, if you look at some of the systems right now that they're developing, for instance, the current system that they're talking about, a space-based system of missile defense, space-based, we're talking about a price tag that goes from $220 to $1 trillion.
Good heavens.
I mean, that's a lot of school lunches. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I mean, that's an incredible amount of money. And frankly, we don't have systems that work yet. So we're really talking about making a show, but not making something very substantive. And the other thing is, you know, for instance, we're facing with Russia, a country that's got several thousand missiles pointed at us. We can't knock them all out. Against Russia, a system like that is totally useless. We could possibly knock out something from North Korea. We might even knock out most of the Chinese satellites if they were actually launched at us, or at least half of them. But let's suppose that the other half got through with hydrogen bombs, and they knocked out 10 American cities. This is something we just can't afford. We can't afford to just knock out some of them.
We're talking to Craig Eisendrath. You know, when I hear you talking, when I read things about this, it seems like a very strange and elaborate choreography. It seems almost unreal. To what extent is the reality, you know, the possibility of vaporizing cities with millions of people on them? I mean, the actual reality of what these weapons do in the consciousness of the people who are building them and allocating the money for them?
Well, you know, starting in the 60s, really, the Russians had the capacity to inflict enormous amount of damage on the United States. I was in the State Department at that time, for instance, in the 60s, and we used to get reports from the Rand Corporation saying that within the first hour, there'd be 100 million dead, and that the planet would be polluted for good. That's how bad it is. And a lot of that capacity, particularly with Russia, is still there. And we're still dealing with a country that's got many of its missiles on full alert. What we need to do with the Russians is negotiate to get those missiles off of alert so that we're no longer in the danger of an accidental launch, which could still cause that type of damage.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the Cold War over?
It is, but the missiles are pointed at us.
Why are they still pointed at each other?
Well, that's what we need to negotiate. You see, we need to sit down with Putin and say, look, let's get off this. Let's get ourselves a system where we're no longer in this type of danger. The Cold War is over, Mr. Putin, but let's take our missiles out of the Cold War.
Do we have those kinds of missiles pointed at them as well as they at us?
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
And we have also them pointed at the Chinese and the North Koreans and probably Iran.
Now, when we talk about all this money being spent, we're spending it here. To what extent are they also spending it in Russia, in the European Union, in other countries, on weapons in space, on military satellites and things of that nature?
They're spending a considerably smaller amount of money than we are, even in development. What's interesting is this, that the European Union, China, and Russia are willing, and have said so for years, are willing to sign a treaty with the United States knocking weapons out of space for good. That is to say, we will not put weapons in outer space. We will not put anti-satellite weapons or bombardment weapons in space. They're willing to sign a treaty, and the rest of the world is willing to sign a treaty. We're really the only major power that says no, and we're dealing with a country that, up till now at least, has talked about full-spectrum dominance. That is, dominating the land, the sea, the atmosphere, and outer space. And we're talking about a president who in October said that he would not accept any inhibition on the American space program. Came out with a very angry, you know, warlike doctrine of space dominance. We've got to get off of that. We've got to start cooperating with other countries and take space out of the arms race.
We're talking to Craig Eisendrath. When you talk about full spectrum dominance, it sounds kind of like wanting to be the biggest and strongest chimpanzee in the group.
That's right.
And, you know, in the human race, as well as many other species, we have that. You know, there always seems to have to be an alpha. Is there another paradigm possible given the limitations of our psyches? Or is there another way to genuine peace and still maintain some kind of dominance or sense of that alpha?
Well, sure. And I think what you do is you go for an outer space treaty. You sign a treaty. You meanwhile, if you want to protect yourself, you do what we've done, and that is we've done research on weapons so that, in fact, if everything breaks down, we could use them. Although, frankly, most of the weapons we've been talking about are not very useful. We can get the same effects from the ground. Let me give an example. If you want to hit a target on Earth, all you have to do is launch an intercontinental ballistic missile. It's about 1/20th as expensive as launching that type of attack from outer space. We don't need the outer space weapons. They're not really necessary for our security. We've done the research. We could, in fact, develop them if we wanted to. But frankly, they're not very useful. We'd be much better off simply giving the thing up altogether, signing the treaty, and saying, look, There's one part of this spectrum that we're not going to weaponize, and that's outer space.
Now, the barrier to that is that, what would you call it, alliance between politicians and some of these very major military space contractors.
That is a real problem. There's a very good writer, Bill Hartung, who tracks this, and he's written a number of articles and books about it. He writes for The Nation, but what he does, and also Teresa Hitchens at the Center for Defense Information, what these people have done is really track this type of lobbying, and it's pretty ugly, because what these outfits are interested in is long-term, very lucrative contracts, and they're willing to pay up front to politicians the money that the politicians need. In order to get these contracts. One of the things we've got to do as a democracy is to rule out this type of misuse of funds, make it illegal, and not just not permit it to go as it has year after year, corrupting our legislature, and by the way, really destroying our security.
Well, this is another point that I think it's very important to talk about. I mean, spending a lot of money on weapons for all of the horrors of it, moral and financial and so on, some people could make the argument it's worth it because it improves our security. But you're making the claim that it doesn't even do that.
No, it really doesn't. Most of these systems are absolutely not necessary, particularly, by the way, if the other countries are not going to launch these weapons. The only reason for even to think about these weapons is if other countries had them. But what if we simply signed on the line and said, we're not going to do it? The system, a treaty like this is very easy to monitor or enforce because we can track anything that's up there. You know, this is not like, you know, making a nuclear facility in a bunker and you can't see it. Because anything in outer space can be tracked. You can't cheat in outer space.
Right, right. So the cost of making these weapons is just infinitely higher than the cost of making treaties and enforcing them. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing is, look, we've tried this hegemony business, you know, the superpower. And we got stuck in one country, Iraq, and we realized in one country we've used up a lot of our military resources. This is a route we can't take. We can't take the idea that we're not going to cooperate with anybody. Rather, we've got to now swing back and look at international cooperation, as we did, by the way, after World War II, when we signed on to the United Nations, we signed on to the Limited Test Ban, we signed on to the Outer Space Treaty, we signed on to the Non-Proliferation Pact. we've got to go back to that tone and sign on to a comprehensive nuclear test ban. We've got to sign on to a treaty that limits, you know, fissile nuclear materials. We have to de-alert nuclear weapons. We've got to come up with a no first use doctrine on our weapons. I think we've got to start fulfilling our obligations under the Non-Proliferation Pact by really destroying some of our nuclear arsenal. Those are things that we can do in cooperation with other nations, and the result will be widespread international security cooperation, and by the way, the making available tens and hundreds of billions of dollars for peaceful purposes.
We're talking to Craig Eisendrath, co-author of The War in Heaven, The Arms Race in Outer Space. To what extent do we already have treaties of this nature, and to what extent do those treaties exist and we just haven't signed on to them?
Well, there is a treaty on the books waiting for the United States to sign on the deweaponization of outer space. There is a comprehensive nuclear test ban that's ready to be signed. There's a lot of this stuff waiting for us simply to sign, and we haven't done it. That is, the world is waiting for the big superpower to realize that it's not that super, it can't do it alone, that it needs the cooperation and of other countries in order to make a safe world.
How does all this play out in the world we're living in today, in which there's a lot of major security threats, or seemingly so, that come from non-nation states?
Well, that's a very different business. You don't have a terrorist that can launch a satellite, because it takes an enormous amount of money, huge facilities to do this. What you're dealing with here is the real danger. For instance, that these are dangers are real, that a terrorist, for instance, let's say from Russia or parts of the former Soviet Union, a real terrorist could get some fissile material on the black market, could pack it up and explode a dirty bomb, let's say in New York or San Francisco or Chicago, and literally kill thousands of people and pollute major areas of a city. This is a real danger, and it requires some very sensitive, effective security to protect the United States. Those dangers are real, and I think we've been enormously lucky since 9/11 that we haven't been hit by that type of nuclear terrorism.
But that really has little to do with what's going on in outer space. In order to make outer space weapons, you basically have to be a nation.
You do, because you need that much money and those kinds of facilities. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars and totally identifiable facilities, you know.
Right.
You can't get an Osama bin Laden type person to launch a satellite. You know, we're not
right.
That's just way out of their reach.
Now, the European Union is a place where, I mean, they have comparable interests to ours, culture, religious background. Why do they make such different decisions about these matters than we do?
Well, they certainly do. I think maybe they're a bit more mature. Right now, for instance, on a income basis, the European Union is spending one quarter as much on the military as the United States. The result is that they have, for instance, a program which takes care of their citizenry so much better than we do. I'm talking about health, education, welfare benefits for the poor, for pregnant women. All these kinds of things are 2, 3, 4 times better in these countries than they are in the United States. And they use the money that they don't employ for military purposes to really help their own citizens out. We've got, for instance, 48 million people with no health insurance. We've got 28 million people that are living below the poverty line. We have a minimum wage right now of $5.15 an hour. I mean, this is disgraceful for a country of our wealth, a country that's democratic and is supposedly compassionate and wants to take care of its own citizens. We could use those funds that we squander on military, useless military equipment to take care of our people, very much like the European Union does.
It seems that we could also put a lot of that money into alternative energy research and food production. If we did that, if we really took away, let's say one half to two thirds of today's United States military budget, put it into other things, what do you think would happen? I mean, you're a State Department person. Would there be a security risk to the U.S.?
I don't think so at all. Quite the contrary. And let me give you another example. The United States made a very grandiose gesture at the, you know, when we offered to spend 0.7% of our gross national product on foreign aid. And it's been calculated by people like Jeffrey Sachs and so forth that that amount of money, if it's spent by the wealthy countries, would really would eliminate major poverty in the world. But the United States has not come up with its pledge, has not met its pledge. We're presently giving about 1.7% of our gross national product. We're one quarter of what we actually promised. And the result is that there are a billion people living in dire poverty, and that 10,000 people, kids mostly, die every day because of starvation and malaria and things like this. These are kids that we could help with a small sacrifice of our great wealth.
We make arguments such as the ones you're making about the economic realities and so on. There's also some kind of, I guess, again, a big paradigm ideas that need to be talked about as well. When we think about what the purpose of these missile defense systems and space-based weapon systems are all about, it's essentially to make an impenetrable shield around the country. That is the idea of security basically as surrounding us with a big steel bubble or something like that. And as we know from the study of biological ecosystems, isolation is impossible. I don't know. What are your thoughts on just thinking about the whole thing in a different way, maybe from a more biological perspective?
Well, I think what we've now learned in, from a biological perspective, is that we're one world, that the global economy, the global organism, you know, to use your metaphor, is real. We really are tied up with the rest of the world. But if that's the case, we have to act that way. We have to work in cooperation with other nations. Another example, for instance, is the Kyoto Protocols, you know, where the planet is really in serious danger because of the emission, hydrocarbon emissions. The United States refuses to sign on. We're creating 25% of what's up there, and we won't take any step to reduce it. And you mentioned, for instance, alternative fuels. The research that we're putting on to alternative fuels is going down under the Bush administration. Far from stepping up the research and trying to find alternatives to oil, which is, after all, involving us in wars and military enterprises all over the planet, we're actually reducing that kind of research money. We've got to step up to our responsibilities as part of the world organism, as part of the world working together for mutual benefit. We just haven't gotten that mindset yet, and we desperately need it. Time is running out for us because, you know, as Al Gore says, for instance, the planet's going to be in very serious shape if we don't start changing things with regard to these emissions. We're also, for instance, there's a billion people living in dire poverty. Many of these people are deeply angry at us. They're potential terrorists and so forth. if we helped them out, if we were the beacon of hope, if they looked to us for the betterment of their lives, we wouldn't be in the type of danger we're in now.
We're talking to Craig Eisendrath. If we were to make such a shift, would there be a positive role for Boeing and some of these other military contractors that are doing these types of really crazy weapon space systems? Would there be an alternative role for them? What would happen?
Well, sure there would be. One of the roles they could take up is the peaceful uses question. We could have a considerably richer system of weather satellites, positioning satellites, those kinds of systems certainly could be developed by them. It may be also, frankly, that certain people in the arms industry might lose some money. That doesn't make me weep, you know?
Right, right.
I mean, they've had a good run for a long time, I mean, if the world were to go peaceful and a few companies would, you know, have smaller contracts, well, that's the breaks.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm not going to weep too much for Lockheed Martin.
No, but they're going to be clinging onto the status quo for as long as they can, presumably.
That's right. That's right. And I think there are alternatives, certainly in the space business. There are alternative uses of space which are peaceful. And we could certainly stick a lot more money. But let me give an example. We could stick a lot of money into scientific research. Right now, we're cutting it back. NASA is really in very serious shape because of the cutback in money for scientific research. We've got such an opportunity, the first time in the history of the mankind, that we can explore where we are in the world. And we've learned, for instance, and this is kind of staggering, that there are 100 billion galaxies, that we're a just spot of dust in this world. We still are figuring out how the world was created. We're still figuring out questions of the dark matter in the world, the whole alternative energy systems, which we're just getting inklings of, that exist in the universe as a whole. All this could be explored in considerable more detail. We could also, for instance, have landings on a number of our planets in the solar system, and we could begin to check out the possibilities of alternative life forms on this solar system and in others. And I know that someday, maybe not in my lifetime or yours or even our kids, there are going to be other intelligent beings with whom we are in contact. What a thrilling perspective! All that could be advanced through the peaceful uses of outer space.
Now, you were in the Army and then you were in the Foreign Service. Tell us more about your career and your own observation of all of these issues.
Well, when I started in the State Department, it was early in 1958. I mean, it sounds like, the Pleistocene era.
Hardly.
But we had just put our first satellites in outer space, and in the world, everything was new. I mean, for instance, we had no idea at that time who owns outer space. For instance, when Columbus discovered the New World, he said, "I lay claim to this world in the name of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella." I mean, could we lay claim to outer space, or could the Russians? Could we actually own outer space? Can we own the moon? Can we own Mars? Those are real questions we asked at that time. We decided no. Unfortunately,
and have we really
common property.
Have we really decided no? I mean, is everybody on the planet signed up for that?
Well, they did sign that. They did sign the 1967 Outer Space Treaty. They did.
Okay.
And so they've signed off on the ownership question. But what we didn't do at that time in 67, much to my regret, is although we knocked out weapons of mass destruction in outer space, we didn't knock out other weapons. And even now, the Defense Department, I read several documents that came out of the Defense Department the last couple of years, assuming that in 10 or 15 years we'll actually be orbiting nuclear weapons, as if the treaty doesn't exist. And it's interesting also to remember that in December of 2001, the president said, you know, we don't have any more a treaty on missile defense with the Russians. You know, we had outlawed missile defense in a treaty in 1972, and he simply said that treaty is void now.
And it was void just because he said it was?
Yeah, the president did it on his own, knocked the treaty out, and didn't even go to Congress, didn't even talk to them, simply said it's over. So we've got a very shaky system right now where the president is assuming he can knock treaties out anytime he wants. We don't have the security even of the treaties we have.
To what extent are there citizen movements and indeed citizen awareness about this issue, the militarization of space?
Well, there's some wonderful organizations like the Union of Concerned Scientists and outfits like that. My own outfit, the Project for Nuclear Awareness. There are organizations like that all over the country that are aware of this and are deeply concerned and are talking to their Congress people and saying, look, this is the time now that we've got a majority in Congress. This is the time to say no to these weapons and to sign on to a treaty. This is the time when we've got to turn back from the idea of weaponizing space and start talking about securing its peaceful uses.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us here on KSFR.
Well, thank you very much, and you're a terrific interviewer.
Oh, thank you.
I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Craig Eisendrath is the chairman of the Project for Nuclear Awareness. He's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, and he's the author of Bush League Diplomacy. And he's co-author of the new book, The War in Heaven, The Arms Race in Outer Space, published by the New Press. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. We are on the web at ksfr.org, and you can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.